Hello, can you hear me? Repeat, respond if you can hear me.
Mm-hmm.
It works! I can hear you! Would you talk to me, please? Who are you? What's your name?
What?
Are you talking to me?
No.
I'm not out there. I'm in here.
Did you hear that?
Hear what?
You didn't hear that then?
No, I'm sorry. I didn't hear anything. Are you feeling all right?
Would I be in a doctor's office if I was feeling all right?
Look, pal, we have to talk.
No, we don't.
Don't what?
Don't have to talk.
Yes, we do.
We do?
Do what?
Have to talk.
Not unless you want to.
I'm in here, inside you, inside your body.
Oh, God. Somebody help me. I'm possessed.
I saw it on Linden Street.
Hello, and welcome to I Saw It on Linden Street, the show dedicated to the joy of finding an appreciation in cult films, exploitation oddities, beloved classics, and all points in between. I'm your host, Chris Roberts, inviting you to join us here at the Linden Street Cinema Experience Theater, as we once again dig up a fun cinematic relic from the past. Now, if you're new to the show, thank you so much for joining us. This isn't your standard film review, rather it's a synopsis of a film that we feel deserves to have another inspection, with a little bit of background thrown in on the actors, information on the director, and hey, if I'm doing my job, you might get a half-amusing story out of me. Now, fair be warned, while we don't cover all aspects of plot, we do discuss endings and spoilers, so if you'd like to be surprised, please give the film a viewing before you listen to us. If you like us, and hey, I would hope that you do, please recommend this podcast to a friend, give us a favorable review, subscribe. We're still continuing on January's theme. That's a slate of some really excellent movies, all about shrinking, that we call Let's Get Small. And this week, we are screening Joe Dante's 1987 classic sci-fi romp, Inner Space. Join us! Now, this week's film was always a movie that I would catch just bits and pieces of, and that was when it was on TV. And it took almost 20 years for me to sit down and actually give it a proper watching start to finish. I gotta admit, and I'm sorry to say this, I've never been a huge Martin Short fan. Don't get me wrong, I think he's very talented, and I think he's very fine in supporting roles. But whenever he was given the lead in something, you know, things I'd watched growing up, he'd grate on me. And I'm thinking of movies like Pure Luck or Captain Ron, where he just was insufferable. Again, just my opinion. But the flip side is, when you put him in as a side character, where he was sort of just movie helper and he got to be wacky, come in, do some jokes, and then breeze out, you know, playing Franck in Father of the Bride, the remake and its sequel, or where he plays the agent in The Big Picture, that's when he gets to shine. And again, this is all just my humble opinion. There's no evil intent towards Mr. Short. Thus, this was always a film that I would catch in, you know, dribs and drabs on deep cable, and I'd end up watching like 15-20 minutes at a clip, and by doing that over the years, I ended up seeing about 95% of the film. But it would not be until I started living with my wife that she made me sit down and actually watch the film proper from start to finish, as this is one of her favorite movies. This all strikes me as amusing for several reasons. First, because we don't really see eye to eye on a lot of films. Second, she is not really a fan of Joe Dante's movies, where I am. And third, things that we both tend to agree that we like, as at least as being good, are not often things of cinematic quality. But in the end, I have to say this, and this is now going to be put onto audio for all eternity, my wife was right. In sitting down and screening this film from start to finish, this week's movie is not only just a worthy entry for our thematic month, it's also a funny, entertaining, over-the-top piece of filmmaking that should absolutely be seen by more people. Now, as I've stated before, I do love me some Joe Dante, and what I would like to do is really take the time to get into him proper, but I don't feel I have that time to do a proper deep dive on him this week. So, not to give him short shrift, I'm going to end up saving that for a future episode where I can really get into some more of Dante's wonderful work. Suffice to say, this film was made right after Dante had experienced a string of very successful pictures, and then he had had his first real defeat at the box office. He had made one of my all-time favorite films from my youth, 1985's Explorers, which, again, it's going to be a future episode for sure. Stinging from that film's lack of success and putting his time with Paramount Pictures behind him, Dante was looking for another project to start. Now, he still had respect, he still had clout, and he had both Steven Spielberg and Warner Brothers wanting to work with him. They basically wanted to say, hey, we did Gremlins, let's recapture that magic and make another hit. And honestly, this was an age where if Steven Spielberg thought you were talented and said, we should do something, people would put down whatever they were doing, open their wallets, and listen. And they would pony up their hard-earned cash just for the chance to join him on a project. So, all that said, let's break it down. So, you have Dante coming on board to once again partner with shooting a film for Amblin Entertainment, with Spielberg, of course, since it's his production company, producing, and Warner Brothers coming on board to distribute, with the full power of special effects being done by Industrial Light and Magic. And what you're going to be making here is a very simple science fiction romantic comedy. It was a little story that had been inspired, and by saying inspired, we mean blatantly lifted from source material that was Fantastic Voyage. What you're going to get is a picture about a military man volunteering to be a part of a shrinking experiment who then accidentally gets injected into the body of another man who then has to have some crazy adventures to eventually get the person out of himself and re-enlarge him, all before he runs out of air. Sound fun? Duh. Yeah, totally is. Well, great. They needed to come up with something for a script, and in doing so, they had to basically scrap everything that was in the original draft and bring on a new writer. The initial script was done by a man named Chip Prosner, and that was more of a straightforward adventure film. But Spielberg himself saw this as becoming more of a comedy, and so he brought in writer Jeffrey Boehm to come in and overhaul and rewrite the script that Warner Brothers had optioned. And Boehm basically approached the story as, yeah, we're going to have an adventure, and it's going to be science fiction, but let's make this something of a buddy picture. And he pitched this both to Dante and Spielberg as, well, what if we shrank down Dean Martin and then we had him injected into the body of Jerry Lewis? Hijinks would ensue, right? Of course. But that fact that the story was in flux and kept going back and forth tonally made casting for this to be actually pretty hard. You see, Dante himself had originally wanted an older actor to play the role of our lead, or should I say one of our two leads. So Lieutenant Tuck Pendleton was going to be an older guy, a man who was at the end of his career, seen as sort of a washed-up pilot who just wanted to go out with one big final mission that he could call a success. And of course, in doing the character, they could play up his gruffness, his drinking, and that could all be done for humor purposes. Now, Spielberg had actually envisioned the part to be of a younger man, and in doing that, he had already had his eyes on a young Dennis Quaid. So much so that he suggested the actor sit down and talk with Dante, and then, if they like him, they could tweak the part to being made for the 30-year-old. Quaid got the script immediately and liked it. He thought it was fun and that this would be a real great opportunity to be involved in a story that was meant to be silly, fun, not anything too serious, but still could be a big screen adventure. And thus, after meeting with Dante, he agreed and the man was cast for the part. Now, for the other role, that Jerry Lewis role, Dante himself was pretty unsure about using Martin Short to play the hypochondriac character Jack Putter. He had seen Short on SCTV, mainly doing his Ed Grimley character, and he was not really certain that he could sustain a film. Now, to date, Short had only had a couple brief appearances in film. He was in 1979's Lost and Found with George Segal, and then he had just finished shooting The Three Amigos with Steve Martin and Chevy Chase for director John Landis, but that film was still in the can, and it wouldn't even be released until December of 1986. So, basically, they had nothing to go off of except for Short just saying how much he was interested. Still, Spielberg and a bunch of the Amblin producers convinced Dante they needed to meet with Short, and once again, when Dante did, he hit it off, and he was convinced we had found our Jerry Lewis stand-in. So, it seems to reason, if you're gonna go with a Martin and Lewis combination, you gotta have a right girl for the two of them to fight over, even if it's only superficial. And thus, they needed someone to fill in for the spunky reporter role that was Lydia Maxwell. Because, you know, what every sci-fi shrinking comedy adventure needs is a love triangle. And to do that, Dante turned to yet another Spielberg suggestion, Meg Ryan. Now, at this point in her career, Meg Ryan was not the big name that we think of her. She was mainly known for her work being on soap operas, and the larger roles that kind of defined her for the 80s, which would have been Top Gun and Armed and Dangerous, they had yet to be released to the public, again, at the point this film was coming together. So she was not a big name. Still, it was evident Ryan had chemistry with Quaid, which would also prove to be ironic as they would later begin dating and they would marry a few years after making this film. British actress Fiona Lewis was cast to be one of the main antagonists, Dr. Margaret Kanker, with Vernon Wells of Road Warrior and Commando fame cast to be her right-hand bionic man, Mr. Igo. You have some real great character actors showing up in this picture. You have Orson Bean and Mark L. Taylor making the cut here, as well as having William Shaller playing Putter's physician, Dr. Greenbrush. And that's really a nice inside joke for a bunch of fans of shrinking movies, because, if you recall, Shaller played Dr. Bramson in the original 1957 The Incredible Shrinking Man. He's the doctor who gets to give our hero, Scott Carey, the bad news that he is indeed shrinking. Throw in some Henry Gibson of Blues Brothers and later The Burbs fame. He's here as Mr. Wormwood, Martin Short's boss at the Safeway grocery store. You also have a young Wendy Shaw here. Most of you would know her as the voice of Francine on American Dad. She shows up as Short's vacuous co-worker. Oh, and for you Married with Children fans, you have Harold Sylvester showing up here. Good old Griff, working with Al down at the shoe store. He's on the scene here as Pete Blanchard, Pendleton's government handler. Also, in one of the better over-the-top scenes, you have the marvelous inclusion with a cameo from two of Short's SCTV colleagues, Joe Flaherty and Andrea Martin, sitting in as patients in a doctor's waiting room. This, of course, would not be a Joe Dante movie if he didn't get to bring in his own personal stock company of actors that he's so famous for using. And so you get Kevin McCarthy showing up to play the villainous industrialist Victor Scrimshaw. Robert Picardo shows up here scene-stealing as the mysterious out-of-town heavy, the cowboy. And good old Dick Miller is yet again showing up here just to play a crusty cab driver. As Dante himself joked, I really hope Dick had a good time here. We only used him for this one scene, but he's my good luck charm, so I hope he at least got a nice weekend in San Francisco on me. With a budget of $27 million, they were going to be doing things right. Dennis Muren from Industrial Lights and Magic was overseeing the special effects on this picture. He would only work on a few minor films like Star Wars and Indiana Jones and Jurassic Park, so nothing big there. But you also had Rob Bottin showing up here. You might remember us singing his praises for his work on films like The Thing, and he had previously worked with Dante on 1981's The Howling. He managed to come up with some of the cool and bizarro transitions that occur when Jack ends up morphing into the cowboy, using selective muscle control. Yeah, that's a real sentence, and we'll get into it later. Now, shooting for this film took place in the summer of 1986, starting at the end of July and then wrapping by mid-October, shooting both in and around San Francisco and Los Angeles for establishing shots and for a few of the car scenes. But honestly, the bulk of the picture itself was done on the Warner lot in sound stages. As is his calling card, whenever Dante has access to Warner Brothers Pictures, he utilizes the Warner Sound Archive, and this movie is once again loaded up with a bunch of sci-fi noises and crazy sound effects from classic Warner Brothers cartoons. Dante never had a formal title for the film that he actually liked, and for the longest time, he just kept telling people they were using the catch-all Fantastic Voyage 2 as a rough working title before he eventually settled on Innerspace. That was suggested to him by producer Peter Gruber at Warner Brothers. Now, some will tell you that title itself is a reference to the original Fantastic Voyage. They use dialogue between Grant, Dr. Michaels, and Dr. Duvall when they're initially floating through the body as they wax poetic on the seemingly infinite before them, which is Dr. Benish's body. But as Dante would tell it on the film's commentary, yeah, sure, but I still didn't like it. I went along with it because I just couldn't think of a better title. Hey, folks, you've been really patient with me and prattling on, so how's about this? I'll just shut up, and we can get to that trailer. What do you say?
Test pilot Tuck Pendleton wants to make history. Supermarket clerk Jack Putter needs a vacation.
Jack, sir, I'm Jack, sorry. You're late. That's not good. You know it's coupon day.
Lieutenant Pendleton is about to be miniaturized, placed into this needle, and then injected into this rabbit.
Rock and roll.
But something went wrong, and Tuck's about to get a new destination. Inside Jack Putter.
I'm in a man.
Hello, can you hear me?
I'm possessed!
Now, Jack's got twice the problems.
How you doing, Jack?
But he's double the man. With Tuck on his side.
Can you more counts?
In his gut. And on his case.
You're not gonna bag groceries all your life, are you, Jack?
And only 24 hours left for Jack to get out of danger. So that Tuck can get out of Jack. Dennis Quaid, Martin Short. Give yourself a shot of adventure. Innerspace.
Navy pilot, Lieutenant Tuck Pendleton, as played by Dennis Quaid, gets drunk at a black tie affair, seemingly frustrated that he can't tell the world why he has resigned his commission to go to work on a top-secret project for the government. His frustrated assigned handler, Pete Blanchard, played by Harold Sylvester, gets Tuck's on-again, off-again girlfriend, reporter Lydia Maxwell, as played by Meg Ryan, to take him home, and the two of them end up spending the night together. Lydia breaks up with Tuck via note the following morning, but the pilot finds it and tries to explain himself to her. but it doesn't matter. She ends up leaving in a huff via taxi. We are then introduced to the hypochondriac Safeway clerk, Jack Putter, as played by Martin Short, a man who is so frazzled and up inside of his own head, he's driving himself slowly crazy. Overworked and pining for a coworker who doesn't care for him at all, as played by Wendy Shaw, he is told both by his manager, Henry Gibson, and later his own doctor, William Shallert, that he needs to get a vacation. Taking it to heart, Putter goes to the local mall and starts to book a vacation for himself with a travel agent.
Mr. Putter. Well, I certainly envy you. Fun, excitement, relaxation.
No excitement. Doctor's orders.
How about maybe a little shipboard romance?
Well, as long as it isn't too exciting.
Tuck reports to the lab and prepares himself for the big day. He's going to be entering an experimental deep-sea submersible, and then he's going to allow the lab technicians to shrink him down and inject him into the body of a lab rabbit, affectionately named Bugs, and it's there he's going to take a number of samples and help further scientific research. The miniaturization process is a complete success, but before the technicians can end up injecting Pendleton into the animal, a rival researcher, Dr. Margaret Kanker, is played by Fiona Lewis, and a team of her henchmen, led by Mr. Igo, played by Vernon Wells, ends up attacking the lab, gassing and incapacitating the staff, and stealing the computer chip necessary to make the shrinking process happen. Dr. Ozzy Wexler, desperate to save Pendleton, grabs the syringe the pilot is residing in and makes a run for it, traveling down the highway to the local mall, where Mr. Igo catches up with him and manages to shoot the scientist in the back with a silenced concealed pistol in a mechanical hand. As Wexler succumbs to his injuries, he stumbles out of the elevator and goes crashing into the first person he sees, Jack. As Jack awkwardly tries to hold the man up, Wexler injects Putter, putting Pendleton into the unsuspecting clerk's body. Igo views all of this and ends up taking a photo of Putter, but is unable to give chase due to the distance and due to the crowd forming around the now dead scientist. Sore and feeling out of sorts, Jack goes back to work, while Tuck is left thinking he is inside Bugs the Rabbit. And he's confused. Everything is so much larger than he expected, and he can't seem to raise any of the lab crew on the radio. Deciding that he needs to ascertain what's actually going on out there, he pilots the submersible up to the optic nerve, and using an experimental camera probe, he ends up tapping into the nerve itself, which causes Putter to have brief but horrific pain, which freaks out his coworkers, and that allows Tuck to realize he's now in the wrong body.
What's wrong, Jim? What's wrong? Let me see. Let me see.
Come on, where the hell's a picture? Come on.
All right, Oz.
It's not Oz. Who the hell is that? Where's the lab technicians? Where's the lab?
It was just so strange. It was like someone had suddenly shoved a white-hot sewing needle through the pupil of my eye.
Oh, God.
You stand up now, Jack.
What is this? Did Bugs just stand up? What's going on here? This can't be. I'm in a man. I'm in a strange man. I'll be a son of a bitch. I'm in a strange man, surrounded by strangers in a strange room.
You go home and start your vacation today. This afternoon, Jack.
Well, thank you, sir.
And you come back to us a new man.
Do you mind if I use your phone? Maybe I should phone my doctor.
Oh, go right ahead, Jack. What a good idea.
Tuck plants a transmitter in Jack's inner ear, which he uses to have conversations with him. And at first this causes some humorous interactions, where Jack believes that he is becoming possessed, hearing a voice that is talking to him and him alone. Leaving his doctor's office, Jack ends up returning home and deciding that he is going to just ignore what he's hearing. Until Tuck decides he's going to show Jack he's serious, utilizing an EMP device on the submersible to cause Putter's microwave and TV to explode. And that helps get his attention. finally willing to believe that there is indeed a miniaturized man inside of him, Potter agrees to help Tuck get back to the lab and re-enlarge, noting that they only have about a day to get all of this taken care of, because after that, Tuck is going to run out of oxygen. Potter has a messenger come to his apartment, as played by Archie Hahn, but it's revealed that he is actually an agent for Kanker, and he pulls a gun on Jack. Tuck ends up talking Jack into fighting to save them both, and the Safeway clerk finds the strength to grapple with the man for the gun and eventually knocks him out, making a successful escape back to the lab. Through Jack, Tuck is able to convince Pete and Dr. Niles, as played by Mark L. Taylor, that it's him inside of Putter. And when he learns that they don't have the microchip anymore to reverse the process, and that they're going to have to sacrifice Pendleton for security of the project, Tuck, understandably, freaks out a bit.
Excuse us a minute. Let me talk to you outside.
Stay here. Both of you. Oh, it's good. Well, you're home free now.
Oh, yeah? I never trusted Pete Blanchard. Can you see where they went?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, now look directly at them. Don't turn your head. I think I can beef up the reception a little bit.
I've been trying to get here for 5 weeks. I'm just trying to explain to you exactly what's going on.
Explain
here,
it
right?
To them.
Look, we're not the only ones working towards miniaturization.
Don't you think I know that, Niles?
Yeah, I can hear them.
Yeah, I know. Shut up and listen.
Sorry. But we are the first to perfect the tricky re-enlargement process by using two chips. Now, one of the chips is in the pot.
And the other one has been stolen. Now, what do we do to save Pendleton?
Recover the stolen chip.
Don't you have duplicates, Niles?
No, they're prototypes.
That's thinking ahead, Niles.
We can make duplicates, of course, but not by 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
What happens at 9 o'clock?
By 9 o'clock, his air supply runs out.
That is no problem.
All
he's got to do is take the pot down to the guy's lungs, open the hatch, and breathe in all the air he needs.
He can't open the hatch.
The sudden change in the cabin pressure would cause the pod to explode like a balloon.
That's right, Einstein.
Well, then we don't really have to do anything, do we?
What do you mean?
The stolen chip is useless without the one inside the pod, and we've got that one. You build your duplicates. It doesn't matter how long it takes. We'll be right back in business.
Yeah, but what about Pendleton?
We can't save him now, and that's too bad.
Thanks, Pete.
Maybe we can use him. Bring the perpetrators out into the open.
Tuck ends up convincing Jack to go back to Tuck's apartment, where they can plan to find those chips themselves. In the process, Jack learns more about Pendleton's life. They end up sharing some drinks together, tapping into a reserve of Southern comfort, as well as dancing about and talking about how perhaps Lydia can help them get to the bottom of this. Jack finds himself smitten when he sees a picture of her, and Tuck starts getting a little jealous over the clerk's interest in his girl. Still, Tuck has Jack take his jacket and his Mustang over to Lydia's, and the young lady doesn't initially trust this stranger showing up wearing her missing Beau's jacket and driving his vehicle. Jack tries to explain at a restaurant that Tuck's in trouble, and she finds all of this very hard to believe. Before they can come up with a plan, Mr. Igo shows up and captures Jack, throwing him into a refrigerated meat truck, where he meets Mr. Scrimshaw, as played by Kevin McCarthy, who explains that he is the one behind Dr. Kanker's financing, and it's him that intends to sell the chips that they stole to an international technology fencer known simply as The Cowboy, as played by Robert Picardo. An Eastern European tough guy who decks himself out in boots, bolo ties, and Stetson hats, as well as gallons of cologne. Jack is able to escape from the truck while it's still moving, and he's saved by Lydia driving Pendleton's car. Not knowing how they're going to intercept the cowboy, they end up following him to a club and kidnapping him. Tuck then decides to use an experimental feature that he has on the submersible. It allows him to stimulate Putter's nervous system, and he can control and override Jack's facial muscles, which then painfully transforms Jack's face into that of the cowboy's. And that allows Putter to pose as the fence and to go in his place to buy the stolen microchips off of Scrimshaw. Everything is looking like it's going to work out just fine, until Jack begins to panic when Scrimshaw asks if he can test the cowboy's famous tolerance for pain. And thus, his adrenaline-charged system causes Tuck to lose control of the muscles of Jack's face, which drops the disguise, and then allows for Jack and Lydia to be captured by all of our villains. Now, needing the final chip that is in the submersible pod with Tuck, Mr. Igo is injected into Putter, sent on a search-and-destroy mission to kill Pendleton and get the last bit of technology. While they're both captured, Jack and Lydia end up sharing a kiss, one that pushes Tuck through their saliva and into Lydia's body. Jack and Lydia are able to overpower the guard and force Scrimshaw and Kanker at gunpoint into getting into the shrinking chamber themselves, eventually reducing the villains down to half of their initial size. Tuck realizes that he's inside of Lydia now and discovers that she's pregnant with their baby, and he uses the opportunity to let her know that he is inside of her, playing her their song, Sam Cooke's Cupid. Understanding that Tuck is inside of her, Lydia kisses Jack again to transfer Tuck back into the body of the grocery store clerk, and the two of them race back to the lab, desperate to get the pilot out of Jack before he runs out of air. Mr. Igo catches up to Tuck and attempts to kill him inside of Jack's esophagus, right above the sphincter to his stomach. Tuck ends up pleading with Jack to worry, please give yourself heartburn, noting that he doesn't want to let him die, which generates a large amount of acid, and that is something that Pendleton is able to use to throw Igo into, dissolving his would-be assassin. A shrunken Scrimshaw and Kanker do attempt to attack Jack and Lydia as they drive, but they are repelled, and the two arrive at the lab with only moments to spare.
Jack, you gotta sneeze for me, pal. Can you do it?
Sneeze, why?
Because I don't have enough oxygen to make it out. The human sneeze has been collecting over 100 miles per hour, and right now I'm inside your lung, buddy, and my only chance to make it out is for you to sneeze.
Okay, but how, though? Where is he? He's in the lung.
Think pollen, think ragweed, think...
animal dander, fur balls, just think anything, I don't know.
Hesterman! Somebody, give me some hairspray right away.
Tuck makes his way to Jack's lungs, and Jack is able to sneeze the pilot out onto Dr. Neal's glasses, where he is then re-enlarged with only moments of air left to spare. The three, Jack, Tuck, and Lydia, all end up embracing as the lab techs all cheer, having successfully returned Pendleton to his right size. Months later, Jack is the best man at Tuck and Lydia's wedding, much less worried now and far more confident in his own abilities. He ends up turning down his coworker, Wendy, and then he quits his job at the Safeway. Instead, he's one of the few people to pick up on the fact that the cowboy is actually disguised as the limo driver, taking Tuck and Lydia off, with a miniaturized Scrimshaw and Kanker hidden amongst their luggage. Happily announcing that he's gonna save the day, Jack runs and jumps into Tuck's car, giving chase as the credits begin to roll. Alright, so where do we begin? Well, let's talk about what works here first. I mean, let's face it, the body scenes, where Tuck is shrunk down and traveling through, truly, this is Fantastic Voyage 2.0. It does look amazing, and far more realistic as an exemplar of movie-making technology from the mid-1980s. The deep-sea submersible is a perfect way to take this all in. It's far more logical as a vehicle to navigate the interiors of a human being. Industrial Light and Magic designed these blood platelets out of jello that look amazing. They've modeled the interiors of the human eye, the traveling through the human ear. All of it looks leaps and bounds far better than its 60s predecessor. Now, I get it, we're talking 20 years of technology here, but still, it's far more interesting to watch this vehicle traveling through Jack. And what's more, it needs lights. It needs things like lamps and grappling arms and sample tubes and multi-dimensional maneuvering to make its way through this understandably very dark interior of a human body. Gone are the gauzy pink and blue hues that light the background. Instead, we get these deep reds, these sort of strange pinks and dark black glow of ever so slight illumination, because we're in the enclosed world of Putter's working physical form. Between ILM, Amblin, and Warner Brothers, they all got their money's worth here when it comes to special effects for this film. It looks gorgeous. Now, I have to say this, for my money, the car chase scene is fantastic. It's humorous, sure, but more importantly, it's exciting. I mean, Martin Short is balancing with one foot on the windshield of a moving 68 Mustang convertible, while he helplessly hangs on to a swinging door of a refrigerated meat truck, desperately not trying to fall off onto the pavement, and trying to balance to get himself into the car behind him. It's marvelous. It's funny, but not too slapstick-like. It's exciting, but not completely horrific. If Spielberg hadn't had a hand in this, I would have said, well, this is a clear case of someone attempting to do their version of the truck chase scene that we would see in Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, retrofit it, put it in a new light. But instead, now that you know Spielberg was kind of behind the scenes helping map all of this out, I feel it was him throwing his own two cents in, saying, make it look like Raiders, that would be fun. And for the record, it is. Now, Dante packs this film with a bunch of in-references and with multi-layered jokes that can be enjoyed by parents and kids alike. Although, I have to say, this is a family film rated PG from the mid-80s, so when we're leaning into this, we're going in with material that is both going to intentionally go over the heads of children and even some of the sheltered adults you have in the audience for a good laugh. Case in point, where it's subtly revealed that Kanker is busy having Mr. Igo assist her, we see him swapping out his robotic prosthetic first from a corkscrew to open a champagne bottle, and then, later, slightly out of frame, we see him strapping on some device to his prosthetic stump with some humming occurring, and savvy folks will quickly pick up he is putting on a vibrator. Clearly making this PG offering something that would be harder to pull off today by a long shot. On that same note, I must say, Mr. Igo's death of being melted by stomach acid, it's something that, yeah, should be horrifying and kind of disgusting, but here, it's made to be rather goofy and silly. By first having a somewhat comedic-looking skeleton show up on the outside of Tuck's window, and that sort of takes away some of the horror of the scene, and second, just making it weird enough in the grand scheme of things that you don't really notice with all the other stuff going on. Now, there's no real bad performances here. Everybody involved seems to understand what they're exactly getting themselves into. Quaid is great. He's cocky, he's charming, he's got a bit of that magic charm winking in his eye. He's a sillier version of what we could get to see him do in films like The Right Stuff. You know, the cocky test pilot who's aware that he's involved in something groundbreaking. But in this case, he gets to have a sense of humor about it. Short is equally perfect here. He's not too over the top, even when the script makes him go over the top. For my wife, I think her favorite part is the clip we opened with, where he begins screaming in the doctor's office that he himself is being possessed. And honestly, it's a hilarious scene. Is he foolish? Yeah, but he's the kind of foolish you can relate to and have empathy with, which keeps Jack Putter grounded, still as an awkward but real person. Now, I don't mean to be dismissive of her, but Ryan is just fine here. And that's not really a knock to her. She's not a bad actress by any stretch, but with this final script laid out by Bohm, he doesn't really give her a ton to work with here, aside from looking nervous or shocked or pining for Tuck. So it's more of a critique of the writing of the script and not a critique on her acting. She's playing this part as best she can. What the script really needed was a stronger role for a woman. You know who needs a super shout-out here? Robert Picardo. Now, we love Robert Picardo around here. He's just an amazing character actor who doesn't get the love we feel he truly deserves. Yeah, you may remember him from being Coach Cutlip in the original Wonder Years, or you may think fondly of him as the persnickety emergency medical hologram, aka the Doctor, on Star Trek Voyager. But here, like so many times he's under Dante's direction, you get a real scenery-chewing Picardo. First, enjoying the opportunity to play him as the Eastern Bloc American enthusiast with the character of the cowboy, and then later, he gets to do some real heavy lifting where he plays the role of Jack Putter, looking like the cowboy himself. It's just awesome, and more people should watch the movie just to recognize his brilliance here.
I'm an old cowhand from the Ogrin, but my leg's not bold. And my face not thin. I'm a cowboy who's never seen a cow. I can rope a steer 'cause I don't know how. And I'm not for to start learning how. Yippee-i-oh-hi.
Now, let's talk about what doesn't work for this film. It's really, well, busy. I mean, don't get me wrong, I kind of feel this way about a lot of Dante's work, and it's one of the reasons I love him. He jams a lot of things into his movies. But in this case, it's almost a complete overload. I mean, take this rationally. The picture is groaning under the weight of its own 2-hour runtime. It's a science fiction, slapstick, romantic buddy comedy that includes shrinking technology, gangsters, bionic assassins, submarines, a love triangle, and dancing. Kind of a lot, no? And here, let's dig into this. I understand the concept of a love triangle when it comes to these pictures, especially since we know it's based on that model established by the Martin and Lewis style relationships and their films. But if you have a problem wrapping your head around that, then fine, go back further. Think of those road pictures that had Hope and Crosby. There was almost always one girl that the two leads would be competing for. But in this case, well, Jack is so spazzy and awkward, this love triangle feels just kind of forced and weird. Honestly, you can have him do everything that he has to do in the script. Kiss Lydia, just to move Tuck around, comment that she's good looking, and you could do all of that and still not make it feel sweaty and weird. Because we know, even as we watch the movie, when we're in the middle of it, Lydia is not having any sort of feelings for Jack at all. She's in love with Tuck. So, with so much going on here, in a film that's just overly complex already, it's just one more thing for us to take in and to go, wait, what? Really?
What's the matter?
Nothing. You just reminded me of a time when Tuck wore this chick.
Yeah. That was the night we first met. You were doing that article about me, and talked till 3 a.m. Then I got drunk and threw up and fell down a manhole walking you home.
So it looks like you're pretty hung up on the guy then, huh?
How well do you know Tuck?
Well, we're very close, actually.
Did he talk about me?
that Tuck tends to be a little tight-lipped when it comes to women.
Oh, will you knock it off?
But if I were Tuck, I'd talk about you all the time.
Yeah. Right.
Now, this may be petty, but I have to say something else that always kind of bothered me about this movie in a very minor way. Why is Tuck, a Navy pilot of planes, tapped to drive the submarine? I get it, it's the Navy, you have pilots, I'm not arguing that fact. But don't they have a ton of competent submarine and or submersible pilots that would equally qualify to make the grade? Wouldn't it have made more sense to make Pendleton just that? Now, yeah, I know, historically, Navy pilots have often been the ones that went on to become some of our first astronauts and, you know, record breakers when it comes to both feats of flying and aeronautics. It just seems to be a little too fitting in this case. Why didn't you just make the guy who already knew subs as the pilot? He's already in the Navy. It would have been perfect. It just screams to me lazy writing. Doesn't matter. So I can hear you out there right now. Chris, how was this film received? Well, the word muted comes to mind. As director Dante himself would lament, Warner Brothers test screened this film multiple times and found that the audience reaction was over the moon. Therefore, for some strange reason, they opted to have what he feels was a very lackluster promoting campaign for the film, because they had banked on the fact that the combined names of Spielberg as producer and Dante as director was going to sell the story. You know, the team that brought you Gremlins. They were going to bring you another successful movie. How could they lose? He then also blamed marketing itself and how they promoted the picture with posters, noting that the main poster that was used, the infinitesimally small, tiny ship that was resting on someone's thumb, that didn't tell you anything about the film. The average moviegoer could read the words inner space and would not understand anything about the plot or the tone of the movie based on what they saw on that poster. How would you know it's an adventure comedy? How would you know it's the must-see film of the summer? Inner Space opened on the 4th of July weekend of 1987, and to its credit, the critics were pretty open and kind when it came to praising it. Variety wrote it off as being a smashing miniaturization comedy, figuring that it was going to be headed for huge summer box office gains, with staff writer Cart noting, "The writers and directors have honed this material expertly for maximum entertainment value." Favorite punching bag of mine, Roger Ebert, was equally quick to give props to the film, noting that it's an absurd, unwieldy, overplotted movie, but it's nevertheless entertaining. Box Office Magazine held off on doing its reviews and gave the film high praise, but their review came in the post-summer season, printing in September, looking back and being surprised that the film was not a massive hit at the box office as they themselves had expected. In spite of all the good that was to be found here, they noted that, while the film was decent, the folks here at Warner's must still be shaking their head over this movie's failure at the box office. After 4 weekends, it only made about $20 million, a very small amount for such a big budget item. Unfortunately, though, it was true. Audience members were unsure of what to make of Inner Space, so they didn't line up to see it. Warner Brothers attempted to have a delayed course correction in the summer of 87, going so far as to re-release the picture again with new marketing materials, new posters, new trailers, but what was done was done. Inner Space would go on to just come shy of breaking even, earning almost $26 million at the box office against its $27 million budget. The failure was something that Dante himself was always a little bit raw about, because he felt it was a good film that was mishandled by an overconfident studio. Still, time would tell the tale of Inner Space, and it would go on to become a cult video rental over the years since its release, and it would make a good deal of money being a video rental, turning a profit for the studio and getting the regard that it very much deserved. Now, we know that time was better to Dante in the short run. He would go on to release his own minor contribution to the comedy parody film Amazon Women on the Moon that same year in the fall of 1987, before he would come back like gangbusters with his next project, a little film with Tom Hanks, Carrie Fisher, Corey Feldman, and Bruce Dern called The Burbs, which was a bona fide hit in 1989 and put Dante back on top. Look, the fact remains, I can't sit here and tell you that Innerspace is a film that's going to change your life, or it's going to be the comedy that's going to end all comedies for you. But what it is a solid film that over the years has made its own unique mark, both on the sci-fi genre itself that it's trying to parody, and on the careers of the stars that came to be in it. It's goofy, it's fun, and it's a great picture that has a good head and shoulders above some of the other films that came before it, and it shows that it has mastered the concept of doing shrinking in movies by paying homage to films that came before it like The Incredible Shrinking Man and The Fantastic Voyage. Not so much by mocking them, but by building off of those two films' legacies. You could do far worse on a Saturday night in this case. If you have a film that can be enjoyed by the whole family, with both adult jokes that'll make mom and dad chuckle, while going over kids' heads, with plenty of silly slapstick fun for the little ones, and a good dose of adventure and sci-fi weirdness thrown into boot for everybody to enjoy. So thus, this film can rightfully claim to have it all, for those who are cool and shrewd enough to recognize it. The version of Innerspace screened here at the LSCE was the 2004 Warner Brothers DVD release that comes with some decent extras. You get the film, you have the theatrical trailers, and then you have commentary from director Joe Dante, producer Michael Fennell, co-stars Kevin McCarthy and Robert Picardo sit in, as well as special effects supervisor Dennis Muren, all to discuss the film itself. And all that can be yours today on Amazon.com for the low price of $9.99, which we would tell you here is well worth it. But hey, perhaps that format is too antiquated for you. We get it. But not to worry. A multi-format version is available that gives you the same quality features both on Blu-ray and on DVD. And that's available to you for the low price of $12.60, again, on Amazon, and that's a steal if you ask us. Now remember, folks, we don't get anything here at the LSCE for telling you where you should purchase your movies. We just think in this day and age, it's ever so important to still support physical media, so that these fine companies who own the rights to the films that we all know and love keep releasing that content to us. Because at the end of the day, isn't that just what you want? More of the stuff that you know and love? Besides, Innerspace is such a fun, lighthearted romp that can be enjoyed by people of all ages, with a goofy sense of whimsy and some really amazing special effects. It begs the question, what more could you ask for? So, to you I say, what are you waiting for? Get out there and get yourself a copy of Innerspace today. So that's going to wrap things up here for this episode of I Saw It on Linden Street. Thank you so much for joining us. If you like what we're doing here, that would be the LSCE Dachshunds and myself, please give us a favorable review on Apple Podcasts and hit that subscribe button. Or hey, just do that wherever you're listening to us on. Did you leave us a fun review? Hell, I'll read it here and give you a shout out on the show. Just think of it as my way of saying thank you for recognizing our love of cinema. Please, if you could, swing by, check out our website, lscep.com, where we have articles, episode links, and comics for you to peruse. I'm proud to announce that we've been added to Amazon Music, so if you have an account, simply say, "Hey Alexa, play I Saw It on Linden Street today." We're also featured on Podchaser. That's a podcast database for listeners and creators alike. Find us there, give us a follow and a review if you could, please. And hey, feel free to follow any of the lists that we're a part of to help give us a boost in those rankings. The more reviews and those increased likes, that affects the marvelous algorithms that makes us more searchable. And then we can share more of these films with more people. And you want to do that, don't you? Of course you do! Do you have any questions for us? Comments? Movies you want us to cover? Things you thought I got wrong? We want to hear from you. Please send us an email or an audio clip to lindenstreetcinemaexperience@gmail.com. Do you love social media? Well, we use it here. You can follow us on Twitter at LSCEP, or you can find us on Instagram at LSCE_podcast. If you're really old school, you can look us up and find us on Facebook at Linden Street Cinema Experience. If you want to get even more personable or you wish to contribute a segment in the sidecar, please send us an audio message by way of Anchor. That's a free and easy app to use. So until next time, please take care out there. Wash your hands, wear a mask, stay healthy. And remember, life's too short not to live in the past. Take it easy out there, everybody.
Say goodnight. We sincerely appreciate your patronage and hope we've succeeded in bringing you an enjoyable evening of entertainment. Please drive home carefully and come back again soon. Good night.